Next year, we're going to have this in 2018. So, my name is Clark, and I get as far as over a decade, and it's a great day. I went for a cup of coffee, and I see a bunch of green sheep there, and I came back. Some of my slides today, I'm going to add in this slide, some of the slides that stick through it, but I'm going to leave it in the packet for reference. A lot of work, but you can go through some basic stuff. I think Henry's going to get here. She's over here. She's going to ask you to ask some questions, answer some questions that I've asked about. So I'll stop there. I'll take things right now. You guys, catch up with the slides later on. What's the biggest cause of lung cancer? Lung cancer is in. What's number two? Well, it's in the second hand smoking. So we're not number three. That's it. And so everyone who's going to PhD here, we used to do the classes about these are master's students, master's in statistics. They're also able to set up for PhD here. And then, so what year is this in the training here? It's about first year, so then we're going to be second year. And you're going to have one lecture last year, okay? And then, how many people are from Buffalo area? This side of the room is from outside of the state. Cool, where are you guys? Where are you from?
Saudi,
right? And, not so long. Is that right? That's everybody. And, how did you guys start there?
Europe.
Sorry?
Europe.
Europe, where?
Luxembourg.
Luxembourg, yes. Yes. Same? Both guys from Luxembourg. Cool. Is that there? Is the whole Luxembourg continuum, right?
Colorado.
Colorado, okay.
D.C.,
nice.
India.
India, what about? Sorry?
From
Mumbai. Mumbai, yeah, nice. Great country. I just, one of the chief of our public state department, Dr. Andy Murray, is from Hyderabad. I'm going to visit him there.
India.
Where?
Chennai.
And where's that? North, south?
South.
South. South is where the women are shorter or longer. Like, sure, but that's isn't that like different areas of the names get longer in certain parts of India, for the last name. Okay. Alright, so Emily still has this problem, I guess, printing the slides. I got to wear my eyes a little bit, so I'm really gonna hand out the slides so people can stop listening to me and just do the head. I was telling you, I think we should have this at the KeyBank Arena next year so I can really have an even bigger screen.
An even bigger screen.
Uranium miners,
asbestos. Asbestos causes what's the most common cancer? Asbestos. Wrong. Okay. It's lung cancer is what it causes. Mesothelioma is the most, that's the one that's more linked to. But more people get lung cancer from these it has to get through a lot of material that's starting inflammation. That's a little bit of a trick question. All right, so this is just a slide showing the, it's more of the disease later in life. It's usually get lung cancer when you're less than 35. There are a variety of other things besides asbestos. I guess diesel, maybe depending on where you live, but maybe poor. So this is the size, the most common, lung cancer is not the most common prostate asbestos, but the second most common, but it is the most common killer, and both here in the United States and worldwide. Really a problem in places like China, really. There's many smokers in China, there are people in that stage practice. This just kind of shows that men have kind of gotten better with this since the 90s with the death rate falling. Still, it's more common than that. Women maybe starting to dip down a little bit, but the one thing I didn't really appreciate until late in my career is it kills more women than breast cancer. And that's been that way. That's been that way since the late 80s. It took over from that standpoint. Still growing. Our group, mostly during those time intervals, the women started catching up with smoking. Unfortunately, it is a disease that you don't have any warning signs. But you emerge from a lot of these things are quite large. Patients may have a cough. Coughing with blood is not as common. They're often a short breath. The problem, all the symptoms that we see in patients are existing in patients who have had disease many times. And that's why it's kind of obscured. Patients don't need a cough, or having a cough through all the symptoms, CT scan. And then as the disease gets beyond the lung into the tissues around the chest cavity, they have other symptoms such as hoarseness. Then they can develop systemic symptoms as the mets develop in the lymph nodes and the bones. But then they can also have these nonspecific and paraneoplastic syndromes. Some of the most common ones are patients having kidneys or having basically weakness. They have a lot of bony, musculoskeletal pain, high calcium levels. And the small cell cancers, which I'll show this later, they can have a lot of more general type of symptoms. Now the physical, don't really pick much up except maybe you can pick up a lymph node that's large. They can have new rash such as a zoster. They have chickenpox, they can kind of re-emerge. Clubbing is this finding patients going and see if you get the fingers look like this. Not linked with cancer per se, resolving one of these patients. And the talk about the overall results. It's one that for most patients are going to not survive. In the last couple of years, there's been severe breakthroughs in drug therapy that maybe start shifting the survivals. When a mold more likely to get it, but less likely to lose. And a mold more likely to survive, more likely to get it, but less likely to die. Alright, so I'll give that one away. So, this is what I use for medical students. If you're talking and you've got someone in the family still put, how can you tell them how much more the risk of cancer is? Flash it before. It's 20 times more than a non-smoker. And if you're trying to kind of come up with a rough way of figuring it, it's like cigarettes. In fact, cigarettes has 20 cigarettes plus 20 more times. It actually becomes exponential after that. One interesting thing was, this was a disease of modern age. You used to think people think this has been around for a long time, but it didn't really happen until you had a very efficient way of taking a lot of tobacco products into your body. That happened around World War II. They started putting this into K rations. And everyone was smoking, the old movies, everyone was smoking. And it'd be the, they'd have the doctor conventions, and there'd be someone come up and the doctor would make him show the slide like this, of course, it was just back at this point. And so obviously we've got, you know, problem with cigarettes causing lung cancer. Someone else showed up with the slide and said, here's the rise in sales of women's nylons. You know, these people were totally, you know, no one believed, the doctors didn't believe that, that smoking was causing lung cancer at that time. But again, something more, much more recent disease than you would think. And this just shows that the more you smoke, the more exponentially, the more cancer you'll have, because each puff of smoke has 100 different cancer carcinogens, like thousands of different chemicals, but at least 100 carcinogens. And that becomes relevant because the more you take them into your body, the more the aging and cellular damages you have from that, the more you get cancer. And this is dated a long time ago, but it shows that after, depending on how much you started, the initial exposure level was, and then the amount of time you quit, you can get down closer to normal, but never back to zero. So if you're on a four pack a day, or a two pack a day smoker, it takes longer. 15 years is usually the number that was thrown out there, and if you quit smoking for more than 15 years, the risk has gotten that close to starting, but never quite as close to zero. And why that number is significant is that right now, for getting people into a screening trial for a heavy smoker, if they quit more than 15 years, they often can't get into the trial. So there's given sufficient time for the risk to go back closer to normal. So that's where that data comes from. Interesting thing is, we may not thought about is that the other medical treatments make the risk of cancer go up. The cerebral dying of heart attacks is not going to live long enough to get your lung cancer. So as we improve the survival, people aren't dying in their 40s of heart attacks now. The cancer, these are rates of death. So even if the cancer rate is kind of controlling steady, it might be that your actual treatment is getting better. There's more people that you can actually survive from the disease. And still, heart disease is a major cause of death in people that are 85 and older, but since the 2000s, the cancer is a major cause of death after that. And the other thing, if you're doing research on cancer, you might want to go to a state that has very high levels. Just like I didn't show a roadmap, lung cancer is very sporadically distributed around the world related to smoking habits. And this is the smoking lung cancer. Basically, I didn't show the smoking rates, but it's very similar to this one, which shows that the darker the blue, these are places where patients with much higher rates of dying lung cancer, less so in California. All right, so this is the part of the talk that kind of talk about the tumor biology. And there more and more has been is really being used on practical matter in the last couple of years is the invented drug therapies. There's general definitely chromosomal damage that you see, usually the 3Ps have been the one that's been the most studied. And this happens when patients smoke, they have an inflammatory reaction that tends to drive a lot of this process. And even low smoking exposure, like secondhand smoke, or women tend to be a little bit more prone to this than men. They tend to have more peripheral tumors, like the smokers more distributed out in the periphery, and if they don't have the central inflammation, they can be smoker. So it'd be more if they add pressure, I'll show you this later. So this is the picture that we see in patients typically before we get CAT scanners that come in. They have a big mass here, this is the heart and the lung. And then there's the rib, and you see there's a hollow out area there at risk. And that's stage 4 presentation, which is actually bone metastasis. If you look down through the windpipe, this is the bronchoscopy picture, you take a piece of that, and then it's looked at under the microscope. And did you guys say histology in your training? It's part of the video show you can just take the tissues. That's part of the basic, where you get the, feel like the anatomy, physiology, first year, it's a kind of All right, so this used to be the most common type of lung cancer. Boy Central, this is a tumor that people will look at. It's the cells, the cytoplasm, the nuclei, and there's a bridge between the different cell membranes here. That's typical for squamous cell carcinoma, since it's like a little pearl of keratin on it. And this used to be the most common, but it's still about 40% tends to be central because it's inflammation of the central airway, heavy smoking, tends to be large, and they don't tend to cavitate. They tend to, different pathologies tend to different fertile areas of the mucosa. This has been now not the most common. It's considered to be central south in the periphery of the lung where it's more glandular ones. And that's going to be the adjunct person, which is kind of the most common. This is important because it's a major, I'm going to show later, these two major histologic characteristics define probably different oncogenic pathways and different ways that we treat them with chemotherapy. This is what I was just saying about the adenocarcinoma. Now, the most common histology, both in the United States, usually in most places in the world, but more common in women, and it tends to have a slightly different metastatic pathway, tends to go more to the lymph nodes, brain, bone, moving more to neural tissues such as the brain and the adrenal. This is a version of adenocarcinoma. It used to be called bronchoalveolar carcinoma, now it's still called type 1. But basically, this is maintaining the natural, it tends to grow in a way that it often maintains the natural appearance of the alveoli, the air sacs of the lung. This is more very well differentiated as the other one has a slightly different diagnosis. This one is the opposite. It has very, it looks very bizarre. This is a large cell carcinoma. But all these ones I showed you now have a lot of cytoplasm, a lot of pink cytoplasm around the nuclei. So if they give you a photomicrograph, typically the one that don't give you the magnification of it, you can kind of tell if it's not a small cell or a small cell just by looking at the ratio of the nucleus to cytoplasm. If you see a lot of pink, it's probably not a small cell cancer. And one that's a small cell has most of the nuclear material. And this is just a summary of what I was just telling you. And then they're going to just kind of go over this small cell cancer. This is a neuroendocrine tumor. You see mostly the nucleus is forming the majority of the cell, not much cytokine around it. So the this is one that is actually becoming a little bit less common. Maybe just proportionally. Probably because it is very well, also very high returned by smoking. Very unusual to find this one in the non-smoker. So as we're reducing smoking exposure in the United States, this one tends to become less common. This small cell is driven by a lot of growth factors that get ramped up in smoking. These growth factors are really kind of somewhat unique to the neuroendocrine tumor. There's a pathway of, we think, these Golgi cells, which are the neuroendocrine precursor in the lung, as they get more inflamed and more ramped up in patients with asthma and add inflammation of smoking, they tend to then develop an oncogenic pathway to develop a small cell cancer. And so not only do they wrap up as far as the expression of these peptides, but also the receptors for them. And insulin growth factor is another one for small cell. The oncogenes are the next thing we look at in biology. And they have different expression pathways, these oncogenes, depending on these two major histologies. So we expect to find it's more likely to have this oncogene in a small cell versus a non-small cell. Like I'm going to show you later, a lot of these are very chromogenic within the tumors, and you can find it one place and not another place in the same tumor. Chromosome 3P is where a lot of the tumor suppression genes live. And experiments show that if you can transplant this just this chromosome, unfortunate chromosome, back into a tumor cell culture, you can actually shut down the cancer pathway. There's more losses of this in squamous cell cancers. This just shows, you know, a pathway for the tumor suppression, for the tumor suppression pathway, the P53 pathway and the RB pathways, most notable. Also cell cycle genes, the ones for lung cancer, you've been most certain about it in P16. And there's a nice review article for this in Journal of Breast Oncology. It goes through these subjects. The tumor suppressor, the RB, the retinoblastoma. More common in small cell, if you can transfer it towards tumor growth, less common in the non-small cell. Doesn't seem to really have a survival significance in the non-small cell population. P53 is the most common cancer mutation, more common in small cell mutations. It has had a diverse number of mutations found in the study of lung cancer. The diversity is more likely in lung cancer, and it correlates to the number of cigarettes. So it's just been a common theme today. The more you smoke, the greater the diverse number of carcinogens you're taking out, the more you're going to have damage within that same tumor cell, but also within the subpopulations that form as the tumor grows and matures. And some other tumor suppressor genes. I'm going to move through more quickly because I've added some slides. P10 pathway, ALK, you'll see that coming up later. And so the interesting thing about the P53 mutations, even though we're not really targeting P53 for cancer therapy, is that the mutations are somewhat different based on the whether a person is a non-smoker, whether a smoker, even the what type of version of the carcinogen, cigarette versus coal type of ingestion. That causes a different type of point mutation in P53. The tyrosine kinase is very important. There will be some questions related to the tyrosine kinase, and this is a major part of cancer therapy and a lot more research. It tends to be absent in small cell. That's an important differentiation. The EGFR mutations are relatively the HER1 overexpression is more common in squamous, and mutations are relatively more rare in squamous. So the drugs we have to target the EGFR mutations are really used in squamous cell carcinoma, always the adenocarcinoma. And this is the breakdown because it's a combination. Of smoking prevalence. It's also a combination of race. It tends to be more common in Asian. So if you have an Asian woman who never smoked, this is a patient which has probably less total amount of DNA and pathway damage in their cancer cells, and they're very likely to respond really well to a specific targeted therapy that just tries to suppress the expression of that mutation. This is just that same slide now talking about the other type of mutations based on the author who wrote about it. And in EGFR, in Asian never smoking women, all three studies, very high levels, less so of some of these other. This is probably the most secondary, the ALK mutation is the other one we targeted on the side. So these tyrosine kinase inhibitors, the HER family, then you've got the VEGF inhibitors for the angiogenesis. But this is the dimerization, and then this kind of drives the MNPK, MNPK pathways, and then the increased transcription from the nucleus and cell proliferation survival. What happens when you treat some of these mutations, with the target agent is that over time you suppress the that pathway, and another one pops up. And the most common one is P790 that emerges later. And so drugs now are being developed to not only target both the initial exon 19 and exon 21, but these are the two most common mutations for EGFR in adenocarcinoma. And then they have to add a different drug later that targets this, where they're trying to come up with drugs to do all three and try to get control of cancers as the resistance emerges. The next one is most important in tumor suppression, the ALK translocation. For this pathway that potentially promotes proliferation, again, one that is slightly more, somewhat balanced between Asian and Caucasian. And crizotinib is a drug, and should have seen out here printed, but I have to move this down. And I just moved to a whole different background setting for my slides and stuff back from Rutgers. I'm sorry that's cut off, but I'll try to get that. So the FISH is used to determine whether or not this ALK rearrangement occurs. And it's one of the most common actionable genes secondary to the EGFR mutations. As far as ALK, this is important. Like the oncogene KRAS, K is the most common. It's more common in adeno and squamous, unheard of in small cell lung cancer. But the important thing about this one is that if a patient has this driver mutation, this is not going to exist in the same setting as the patient that has the EGFR mutation. It's rare for those two to occur together because statistically, there's no reason for it to exist at the same time. So the presence of this picture, you should take pictures of different mutations between the therapy. This mutation is different by race. Here, less common in the Asian than in the Caucasian and African American Latino. And these mutations drive again like this, the intrinsic GTP activity, which drives them all the pathways. This is on the slide. Polymerase, this is not as much being studied now. It's much more common to have this activity in lung cancer. Tends to be associated with more advanced stage prognosis. But interesting study, I haven't seen as many articles studying polymerase activity. I think it's a little bystander activity. Haven't seen much. The next couple of slides, the ones that I produced, and this is my older talk, they're still valid, but now the most interest is in setting changes in tumor dynamics and clonality over time, not necessarily getting hung up in some of these individual gene expressions that some are associated with decreased survival, some with improved prognosis. I'm going to skip through these, but really what they try to do, and we go to this slide, this is some of the early work that's done at Duke, and trying to take those pathways and put them into a model where you can get an idea based on its function. You can have a metagene and use cluster analysis to see what could be used to analyze the survival for prognosis. I forgot to mention that these genes sometimes will predict whether or not there is resistance to certain chemotherapies. This platinum is the most common drug used for non-small cell lung cancer in the first line, except for now patients with one of those targeted mutations. But this is a very basic tumor, basic chemotherapy. We don't call that what was invented for, where they perhaps the first major impact on brain cancer. What cancer was? Is that, sorry? No, it was Lance Armstrong. Did you ask Lance to know who Lance Armstrong was? What type of cancer did he have? Yeah. This was, you know, that used to uniformly kill everybody. This was the drug that actually, you know, took those patients to, from not being treated. Yeah, it's probably because it's, you know, it's younger patients, it tends to be just, it tends to be less broken in their human cells. I mean, the cancer is a function of aging. And, you know, simple single agents to cure people. The ERCC, which is a gene which repairs the DNA edits of the cisplatin cause and the plasma cause of that, which prevents DNA here. If you have more gene repair capability, you're going to become resistant to cisplatin. And same with these other drugs here, they all have, depending on how between metabolism or these other, how these drugs work, the Paxil is a tubular converter that kind of causes cell rest, the ability to proceed to mitosis. All these pathways have an explanation for why they work. And these are the ones for EGFR inhibitors. I'm not going to spend any time on this, basically include them in here. Other than the ERCC, I don't think I need any test questions about this, just going to be reference. You may be using this for a reference. These are all things that either based on the histology or matrix of calprotectinases, all these other aspects of things. The study, but there seems to be less study recently. The reason that women tend to be more susceptible is thought to be due to the higher level of a cyclin A gene expression, which tends to allow the bulky DNA edits to occur with smoking and decrease DNA repair capacity. That might explain why women are more susceptible to get the cancers and less likely to, or less or more likely to respond to the chemotherapy, such as cisplatin, which kind of causes this DNA addict. So also, women may have a novel estrogen receptor beta, which tends to drive cancer formation. So how's all this happen? And I'm sure you've heard had similar discussions this summer for spending more time with us. It was a great paper. Did you guys get the paper about a week ago? It was just a nice summer paper about treatments. And it just came out. It was a really cool paper that just came out last week in the New England Journal of Medicine. I'll reference here. It's on the slide, but it relates to the slide here, and it really talks about for lung cancer, when we started to try to treat people by taking a patient who we think to be able to help them out, because those in the lung cancer are smokers. So the logic plan was, 30 years ago, to take smokers and just test them out, chest x-ray, 4 months or once a year, or actually it's chest x-ray once a year and over 4 months, you have cough up some sputum and look for malignant cytology, try to take what they were learning from the past and their dominion and try to, seeing what huge difference that made in survival for cervical cancer, let's see if we can have smoking, most of that time is men dating, smoking a whole lot and getting central airway tumors, and wanting to get them to cough up in the product, see if we can determine whether or not it's no difference. And tons of studies. New York State did a study with 10,000 patients. Mayo Clinic did spend millions of dollars trying to figure this out, trying to protect patients. And actually, we did find more patients early, but it made absolutely no difference in the survival. And why that is related to this cell, because I mean the slide, if you start with a lignin, this is the traditional idea, it's a single cell lignin transformation and by the time it's lived over, it's almost half of doubling, it only has a slide that's up to a million cells, which is only a millimeter, which is way below the detection of a chest x-ray. Then you double another 10 times, and you're up to a billion. Now you can see this on chest x-ray. Unfortunately, at this point, the tumors lived almost three quarters of its life span, assuming it's going to progress to kill the patient. So you have a very little amount of time between finding on the chest x-ray until it's developed regional disease. You would say, to the Lord that recruits for each one of us. So how much time do you think, if I was doing a chest, how much time does it take to go from this size to curable for all cancer patients? It might take 6 months. And that's why doing a chest x-ray every year can make a difference. Now we're doing a CT scan. I'm sure it's a spy that, that's what made the difference. CT scan, you can find it down here, and you get, what's happening here? Why? There's this kind of magical number of a billion cells. Once this goes up to 3 centimeters, that's when you almost always see the regional disease. And then that's why most of the cancer staging systems they have, when it gets to 2 to 3 centimeters, uniformly, it's breast cancer, lung cancer, pick up the higher stages. This is the growth biology. It turns out the tumor size is a pretty darn good indicator of prognosis. It makes sense. Millions of dollars developing a multi-gene signature array to determine the patient's prognosis. But these clinical factors, such as looking at the metastasis and size, are pretty good indicators of prognosis. And why is that? Well, number one, the size is good, but some of these tumors, like the small cell and neuroendocrine tumors, they go from there to there. So even if you find a 1 millimeter tumor, that's a small cell, you have to wear a metastatic and treat them with chemo. So this is the paper I was telling you about that if you get a chance, I think this is going to bear on all if you're working in cancer research. This on the brain. Just came out last week, April 26th, I think, in the journal. It talks about the first initial series of patients released from or studied from a project from home in England. And they're going to go for 500 patients. But what they're doing now that the gene sequencing has got so much easier, this is like the next version after lung cancer adults. And they're doing whole exome sequencing, but not just of one part of the tumor, they're sampling 4 or 5 different areas within the region. And what this is showing is a tremendous amount of what we knew was going on with these progressive mutations. But at some point, the genome doubles, and you have all these subclonal mutations that are occurring. And it turns out that these copy numbers are probably more important. Here's the subclonal. The percentage of subclonal mutations doesn't really change as far as disease-free survival and prediction, but the copy number alterations, meaning the number of different, basically different pathways, and now all each undergoing their own separate mutational changes, becomes such a great problem for the immune system, and the patient can't target it with one drug. They now become almost due to the number of drugs that are targeting these pathways. And so all that stuff I just showed you before, which is good, is it's looking at a tumor just maybe one part of it, a much larger piece of tumor. That's why we're not curing people with chemotherapy but many times. You're missing a significant other portion of it for the tumor. This is, I think, one of the most, this is too small to see people read, but you have to kind of look at the article. What happens is, this is the adenocarcinoma on the left and the squamous cell carcinoma on the right. And it just shows that it starts before actually developing with sequential events, mutations in a single cell. And then at some point there's a gene doubling event and you just get this big wide opening of more mutations, exponential mutations. There's a different type of path for squamous, a different type of development for adenocarcinoma. And this kind of explains why the sun couldn't transition here. Maybe it's why we have a hard time treating squamous and chemotherapy, where we have maybe a more consistent tumor, or less more homogeneous tumor for the adenocarcinomas. But this is good, I think, under the way the future for cancer research is trying to drill down. And not just looking at that one genome, looking at hundreds of genomes in the same tumor, because any one of those genomes, if they're allowed to progress, will eventually come back and kill the patient. And this is also why surgery is still relevant, because surgeons are asked to go back and do additional biopsies of tumors that are more treated, but also the surgery, if you the sad disease is the marketing information, I think, if you want to have a home. And taking out, you know, used to be the lung cancer, the results are so bad, the surgeons, you know, stop operating on high-stage disease. But now, if you're getting better and control the metastasis, you might be asked to go back and actually take out this basically heterogeneous home-based tumor to help improve results. So the little rule of thumb, if the patient shows up, you know, you guys have enough family members that eventually probably most of you have someone in your family get lung cancer, you know somebody with lung cancer. So, you know, these are, I mean, knowing cigarette removal, I think, is useful. Knowing if someone says, oh my God, I got lung, my lung, the patients are getting extremely cancer, what's the chance of that lung cancer? Well, you can ask based on the patient's age. And roughly, you know, roughly the chances of being cancer is about equal to the patient's age, which is very unusual, less than age 35. But once you get over, you know 40s, like 30, 50s, like 40, 60s, like 50. But, you know, if you just had to throw out a ballpark number, someone's in their 80s or 90s, there's an 89% chance of having cancer, a new lump in the lung. And it also goes with what size it is. Once you're over 270 years, at least 50% chance. Or age over 2 is 80% chance, less than 2. It is a range here. 8 millimeters, less than 8 millimeters is unlikely to be cancer. But between 8 millimeters, I think it's progressively more, up to approaching 50%. One test that we do in the clinic is this kind of fuzzy test, PET scan, this is basically a radioactive tracer attached to sugar, and anything that's burning a lot of sugar, like in this case, the tumor here, the brain burns a lot of sugar. These are lymph nodes in the central part of the chest. We use that imaging to help figure out whether or not the cancer is spread out stages. So this is what I was mentioning earlier. So you take the information from before and try to figure out how we're going to select patients. And you know, we can't go any other way through the CAT scanner. But you know, if we can take people who quit smoking but not more than 15 years ago, they've had a history of smoking over 30 pack years, and being old enough to get the cancer, but this data has shown you what went into this formula for the National Lung Cancer Screening Trial. This trial was actually hard to get done because of all the negative trials that have done in the past, they failed because of it's not finding the tumor early enough. It already spread that kind of chest X-ray. It was done 50,000 patients, over 50,000. It was chest X-ray compared to a low-dose CAT scan. And really what it showed was that there was a 20% reduction in death, which was what the primary endpoint was. It's actually a reduction in death that actually exceeds other screening tests like mammography and colonoscopy, and new data. So, going back to what I was saying earlier, instead of picking, you've got all those kind of genes to look at. So, one way that this is before we had just as much computational biology as we do today, but they would take a cell process and they would look at a factor at Duke, and they would go back and see which one of these factors, as far as overexpression, might predict cancer. We've had all five, we had the worst prognosis. They then kicked it up to something that's a kind of infamous study now. You may have heard about it. It was published in the New England Journal in 2006, and there was a problem with it because when we analyzed the data, it was sloppy, and we were working with a cell spreadsheet and didn't correct the problem over. So they basically turned this into a. They had to say the data was true in a way, but they went into because they were kind of sloppy. The research was all had to be retracted. I still included it in the slide set because the data it was valid. They just wanted gene signatures that they clustered them. Couldn't predict for the stage one patient people that we know we have a person to find that little tumor and we take it out. Stage one tumor, no sign of spread. That's still stage one, which is for breast cancer, 90% we tell the person breast cancer 90% cure. For lung cancer, you want to tell 60%. And it's like, that's basically 20 bucks. What good is it? So they're able to take that 60% survival and break it into almost certain cure in people that are very high risk of dying. That was a major innovation, and I only included because that was kind of that was first achieved, even though the data has been replicated in a way, but you know, it was a little different, we did better, less sloppy analysis. But that was kind of the first people to do it. I can give them credit for that. This is some of the other things that come later in that actually showed you. Gene clustering in ways of predicting survival. This was one that was validated better. Some of the work we're doing here, and this was listed on your paper that I sent out, which is microRNA. It's a more conserved way of looking at the DNA, it's kind of DNA processing, RNA processing component of the cell. And the nice thing about it is you don't need to have fresh tissue, actually, you really need fresh tissue anymore today. This is a real solid point for this because you can do this analysis on tissue that's stored in paraffin. And this is from Dr. Andrew Murray's lab that I recruited here. He's able to take that stage one patient and bring him into a good full risk group based on the microRNA profile. There's epigenetics for lung cancer, which is another way of targeting tumors. There's the DNA repair, looking at ways of trying to use PARP to increase the apoptosis of tumors. But whatever you come up with as far as a method. You have to go back to sort of the basic stuff. So just looking at it on a microscope. And when the pathologist has been using their histology with the tumors for the last 100 years, it's amazing how robust this test has still been. They were able to go back and look at the histology better. And then you look at the adenocarcinomas. And this is one pattern of the cells nesting in the tumor. But This is that bronchodilator called lipidic growth. It's like a spiral-like growth along the windpipe. Papillary making little finger-like projections and then micropapillary. It turns out that is a very good way of estimating growth prognosis, as good as many of these gene signatures that we've come up with. Now the radiologists want to get into it as well. So could use computational biology and image processing to look at tissue textures and shapes, and being able to create basically a gene map that correlates with the same gene expression profiles as type of heat maps that you see with the gene expression DNA. It turns out that if you can drill into any kind of manifestation of the tumor, whether it's radiologic anything or histologic, you can get a handle. Maybe just as good as some of these programs out there that we think would be the most scientific thing to do with gene expression. Unfortunately, lung cancer comes in compared to breast cancer, where two-thirds of people come in early stage, two-thirds of lung cancer patients come in with it spread, with locally at this time. What I'm going to do for the rest of the talk here is talk a little bit about the clinical stuff with lung cancer, about how patients come in and how they and some of the treatments. Should we pause for a second? Is there anything that I said that was confusing? Basic conception at this point. All right, so this is the staging system is one that it's gotten complex enough that, we have to, it's good because it's more complex and it's getting more better, same better defined. It used to be really simple, it used to be less than 3 centimeters, greater than 3 centimeters. It turns out that the way these tumors grow and how they spread within the lung, there's nuances that we can do to survival. So each year, or every couple years, it gets re-updated. It used to be that a tumor over 7 centimeters can still only get you up to T2. T3 gets up to a higher stage now. Whether or not the lump is the tumor spreading to the opposite lung versus the same lung is relevant. Whether or not the tumor is growing into the central windpipe, whether it's causing the lung to collapse, whether it's growing into the heart, things that you can't cut out, that's a T4. T4 is usually something the surgeon can't cut out in most of the stage systems. Nodal status is perhaps the biggest driver of survival in lung cancer. So as a general rule, we have these maps where we classify how far it's spread where the tumor started. If it's still within the confines of the envelope of the pleura, which keeps the lung tissue, which encompasses the lung tissue, it gets a double-digit number. That's a level one of the lung. If it's spread, if it's still confined within the organ, that's a level one node. If it goes spreading to the central mediastinum, it's a level 2 node. If it crosses to the opposite side from where it started, it's a level 3 node. Each one has the highest number. 4 is the highest number for T, 3 is the highest number for nodes. And there's maps that we use to classify this. Some of these lymph nodes have turned out to be more nuanced. If it's still a level, the lymph node is real close to the tumor, and it's even though it's an N2 node, it's kind of commuting like N1 node. We have that ability to sometimes give a patient a little benefit of doubt in surgery where we wouldn't. But more or less, we do analysis of this by making a cut in the neck and putting a scope in or the mediastinoscope. But that's more or less replaced by a technology called endobronchial ultrasound, where we can go put a probe in and actually transduce through the windpipe. The other way we can do it is through a technology called navigational bronchoscopy, where we use a computer to build a three-dimensional map of the tumor, and we actually use see the lymph node hiding behind that by using a computer-generated algorithm that's called navigational bronchoscopy. We actually go out to the edges of the lung and biopsy that one too. There are different surgeons will decide which one of these to use based on how close it is to the organ. Like some, the lymph nodes that affect the esophagus, we can put the probe down that one. Most of the cancers in the lymph nodes can be assessed through the windpipe itself now, the endobronchial ultrasound. That's in prospective randomized research, it's been shown to be as good as making a cut of the patient and going down and doing the histonoscopy. The problem with any of these things is that if the lymph node is that, if this black thing is a lymph node, and you're sticking a needle in it, you can imagine that you're more likely to get tumor if the lymph node is filled up with this much tumor, versus if you have to hit one of those cluster here, you may not be able to get it. So there is sampling error that occurs in this. But then the other question is, we know that these cancers are constantly shedding tumor cells. Maybe a little cluster tumor in a lymph node doesn't matter. It's just passing through. If I do a blood sample out of almost any lung cancer patient and had a sensitive enough test to do circulating tumor cells, to find tumor cells, it shows me that the patients are going to have the worst prognosis. Patients with breast cancer can have tumor cells living in the bone marrow for 10 years later and just sit there. Lung cancer doesn't seem to be as prognostic. If you have little kidney cancer clusters, it does tend to produce a prognosis. So this is the lymph node stations that I was telling you about already. The higher the number, the more likely it is to spread further away from where it started. So the N3 is the class which is the worst biology. It means the tumor started here, it's crossed over to the other side, where it's going up into the neck. In N3, just like T4, takes you up to a stage. Three says for the usual surgeon can't have that. So when you take these tumors and others and metastasis, if it's M1, the metastasis is most advised at stage 4 in almost all the staging systems. And if it's just a small tumor, it has no lymph nodes, it's stage 1A. But here, this is the thing. I showed you before, 1A, look at this, still 5-year survival in some series is clinical stage, 5-year survival of only 50%. Now, who knows the difference between a clinical stage and a pathologic stage? I think it's time to pick up the audience and the information. How about Brendan Zen? Is that all right? How do you sign? Oh, you can sign in. All right. How about Lauren Rose Chicas? Chicas or Pappas?
Both.
Come on, let's get it. Was she?
There's one girl.
I have a daughter that's named Tara or Tara. So it's something you find out if you call Tara. If you call Tara or Tara, the good guy if you call. And you're true, I find out how to do it. But so tell me, I gave you a job trying to figure out what's the difference between a clinical stage and a pathologic stage? Right, that's good. So, although if you do a venous sonoscopy, you pull out lymph nodes, and you have pathology there, and the negative is still at that point, still clinical. It's not until you take that main tumor, the whole specimen, which is basically the clinical stage is less accurate. That's the point of the reading papers that you're interested in between clinical and pathologic. So basically, when you look at these developers, they should look better when you go to the pathologic because if there could be tumor in that little lymph node, then you need to take it out and see if it's specimen inaccurately classifying the patient. So, this is the pathology here. So, the pathologic stage, we actually have all the specimen out, and you're sure that that lymph node that wasn't enlarged on the CAT scan, you're actually sure that there's cancer in it, versus the one that wasn't enlarged and actually did, so the patient was actually stage 2 to put up in stage 1 classification is classified. That's why the peritoneal hook is good. But here, this is more the truth. The only time in this pathologic stage is not the right way to look at the paper, if you read, is if the patient is getting chemotherapy and radiation before the surgery. In that situation, the clinical stage can be correct because the patient had a chemo treatment, the pathologic stage was done afterwards, so we go from that stage 3 to stage 1. Pathologic. It was after induction therapy. So the context of it is it's better to have pathologic stage if the patient didn't have treatment before you did that. Okay.
So the
pathologic is called pathologic classification when the surgeon has removed the organ and done an awful lot of operation. So there are some situations where, let's suppose, even the lymph nodes couldn't be assessed. Sometimes they put an X there and you give the patient the benefit of the doubt. But generally, if the patient's had a mastectomy, they have the lymph nodes stage somewhere by a central node. The lung cancer, the boy's lymph nodes are cracked, the boy's in the specimen itself. The surgeon's supposed to clean out the lymph nodes, the sample and the needle, so that they can make an active stage. But there's variability in quality in how the surgeons do sometimes, or the patient's characteristics, the patient's had radiation, the lymph nodes are the same. They're all kind of chromated because of radiation. This is a kind of important concept. So, only a third of patients would come in stage 1, unfortunately, with lung cancer. This is a picture of a lymph node that we call dermatoscopic. It means we have a picture of the tumor in the lung. I'll show this how this works with a little video coming up. I'm going to spend a little time about surgery and some of these treatments because the type of treatment affects the patient's immune function. And more and more now, there's some free drugs coming up and actually you can turn on the host immune system. I'm sure that if you go into research in this area, right now it's such a huge ability. The cancer being the research can turn on cancer almost all based on PD-1 inhibitors. And this has made huge changes. It's taken some patients literally on the deathbed and gotten to long survival. This is a patient with bad lungs. This is back over 20 years ago. I got into doing less invasive surgery. This was made look like a big decision, but that was small compared to one that's this big. And this patient's got glaucoma. The other type of minimally invasive treatment now is this spraying the radiation from 100 different angles. They all coalesce over one area here. And that can kill a tumor very reliably. It's a very high biologic dose of radiation. And that's called SBRT or SABR, as we prefer.
The working port is treated anteriorly in line with the interlobar fissure. Then using a 4 centimeter axis incision.
Okay. Alright, so I just want to show you. This is the this is what a tumor looks like in the middle lobe. And that's the nerve that goes to the diaphragm, the phrenic nerve, that's the heart, sphere being the cava. And the this used to all be done with large incisions, and what you'd have is a situation where the patients would have a lot of pain afterward. And now it can pretty much be done with tools going in through these small incisions. I used to be able to offer to the students, we used to have some students that were thought they may eventually go into get a medical degree and were interested in surgery. And I was able to offer some visiting in the operating room. I just was talking to my secretary beforehand. She says that can be done. It's not much more rigorous process. Unfortunately, things have gotten so constrained. Medicine needs to be able to take visitors from high school and show them operations. But, that's doctors, if people are being interested in doctors. So it's a good thing. It's the other states that you do this. You say, I used to deal with different several calls after one of these lectures and get students in the operating room to see some of these operations. But I think they're cool, but they can give you a certain understanding of how kind of flow of patient care is. You can ask the tumor there, and we're able to do it on the video. I disconnect all the buckets, just disconnect all the structures. This is actually what a lymph node looks like here in a second. This little dark thing here, that has carbon in it from the smoke, cigarette smoke. And by pulling that lymph node off of there, it shows a pulmonary branch. So this is this is how thing that we send that to the pathologist, and they see through the cancer spread from this point down to that lymph node. And that will make the patient stage two or that's an N1 lymph node. Lymph node is up here in the central area where the mediastinum or the vessels coming off the heart that would make the stage two lymph node. Skip through here, but I have more videos. If you're interested in those kind of videos, you can just search my name on the internet. There's some on YouTube and some on CTS, CTS, and I'd love to see surgery and stuff. So the thing about doing the surgery is at the end of the day, we know that a lot of patients still have cancer cells floating around in the pleural space, in the bone marrow, in the lymph nodes, these special staining. And what happens is, that the more you stress the patient surgically, the more likely you can take those little microimplants all over the body called minimal residual disease and kick it into a situation because they had an infection or because they had a surgical problem, they had a blood transfusion. And that kicks the surgical disease into the situation where you might have heard a family member or some patient or someone that you can say, hey, the doctor opened the problem with the area in the tumor. Have you ever heard that the urban consumer? It's kind of an urban legend that's out there, just like a little. So there's always a little truth, and that's if you do hurt the immune system, or if the tumor, the primary tumor, is somehow suppressing the growth of these other microimplants that are being collected in the spleen and the lung, which are basically big filtration organs, by removing the suppressant, the tumor is blossom.
And sometimes that can happen with stressful surgery. The guy says, well, I said, the air back from the tumor. But we know the primary tumor actually, it shed, it actually made tumor and somehow suppressed angiogenesis. And you know, without the ability to make extra lymph nodes, a cell can't get more, or a cluster more of cell can't get much bigger than 8 centimeters, 8 cell layers thick. If you can get microvascular, it grows, but then it can grow. Here's what happens in any type of tumor. This is, these are paper lungs. You take out the main tumor, and then there's this explosion of recurrence of these other distant metastases that weren't really well known. This is another slide that shows that there can be a difference in the amount of circulating tumor cells depending on whether the operation is being done thoracoscopically with that small incision in the cutaneous versus doing an open incision. So I'd like to talk a little bit about the approaches to where you do a cancer surgery, because it actually has a biologic correlation that you can study and may be able to develop, you know, hypotheses. And I think some of this has not been addressed as much by researchers who have been focusing on pathways, and maybe the pathways are being perturbed in surgery when you get tissue from these patients, depending on how you get the big incision and small incisions, and you can make that hypothesis and test that to get new knowledge. So same bone tumors, okay, less than 30%. As a tumor, this is now that same survival curve I showed you before, but showing survival just as the tumor gets bigger. And it's very, you know, just looking at T-SADS alone, pretty good. Because we're getting down here, the bigger tumors, that's when you're seeing the increased copy numbers, the increased number of clones, basically a bigger armor that you have to fight with both either chemotherapy and over the immune system. Small cell cancer, we usually don't operate on, but occasionally catch one that's early, and we can take it out surgically, but they still need the chemo. Stage 2 tumors, this used to only be 5%, but then they changed the staging system for big, once a day, instead of 10 days, now stage 2. And these are basically, most of the time, patients who have a single lymph node spreading in the central part of the lung. So, the other thing that's important about lung cancer when you're trying to study it in predictive models is that it's occurring in a population that has emphysema and has heart disease from smoking. And the older age group, it is actually the non-cancer specific problems that lead to the patient's dying. So when you're looking at survival curves, depending on the age of the population, you're trying to study the tumor biology. Based on patients, you have to understand that in older populations they get lung cancer, usually the cancers are often slower growing because they can be it's something more of a consequence of aging, maybe not so much smoking exposure. A tumor that's not going to be as aggressive and as much metabolic activity. Versus if someone younger, to get a lung cancer at a young age, remember lung cancer is the most heard of for cigarette smoking. There has to be a lot more study to start the pathways and disrupt it and kind of be more aggressive to them. And this just shows, as I was mentioning, the vast amount of surgery that the survival for patients getting less invasive surgery is much better in older patients. Probably because less invasive surgery doesn't cause them to become debilitated and frail. It doesn't take much disruption patient's chest that age, sort of the nursing home, and then die of a complication. Blood loss is another big thing that favors making small incisions. And we know that blood transfusions in any kind of patient, even one that doesn't have cancer, increases the linear risk of mortality. This is a study that showed 2,000 patients. Just giving them a single transfusion tremendously increases the risk of dying compared to no blood transfusions. And that this hasn't been published yet, it's just an abstract, but really the estimated blood loss is an independent predictive for survival. And it's understandable because when I used to do heart transplants, prior surgery, but blood transfusion or transfusions were what we used to use as heart patients to get them susceptible to work. So it makes sense that blood transfusion is going to allow cancers to get engrafted. The other thing I found is my frail small incisions allowed them to stay off of narcotics, which is serious, but yet, two-thirds of people with big incisions in that frail old group would have pain for lasting 3 years. Why is that significant? Well, it turns out that one of the pathways that can be reduced is the new opioid receptor can reduce the growth of EMT in lung cancer preparation and tumor cell migration. So if the patient is popping more pain pills after a painful incision, we're going to be driving the cancer genesis in the next year. And this is just another slide showing that this level is better for people whose pain is well controlled after the cancer surgery. Stage 3 cancers are ones that we don't typically operate on. T4, like I mentioned earlier, is growing into stuff that you can't cut out, like the aorta. We can cut it out, but it's going to take a heart lung machine or something really radical. And it's questionable whether or not that changes the patient's prognosis. And then the metastasis is the final of the TNM staging system. It turns out that the word spreads is irrelevant. If you have what's called elephant metastasis, which is just a spread to one part of the body anywhere else, such as, say, lung cancer spreads to the brain, a single spot, that may have a slightly better prognosis than getting the bones and all over the body. So there's more interest, because we have better staging tests to actually treat people with stage 4 disease, the body is not spread very much. When it's spreading like this, meaning filling the whole chest cavity up, putting the heart sac with multiple tumor nodules, adding this, even though maybe confined to the chest cavity, that's still metastatic disease. This is a slide you should know. This gets tested on. You should know this, in general, what type of other organs that lung cancer might be based on. This doesn't change much. But lymph nodes, by and large, the same cancer is going to be where it goes, except for sarcoma, they tend to go to the lung, and not to the lung. Almost every epithelial cancer lymph nodes are going to be the point of spread. Then the lung cancer, bone, adrenals, heart, down lower, who knows right there. And this is spreading, this is the lung cancer spreading into the pleural space. And these are things, you don't need to know these, but these just kind of show you about the stage, and these are kind of test questions that you get because this is a high stage. And small cell, distant mass, if you can't cut it all out, basically, if the patient doesn't have enough lung to breathe after you take out the tumor, those are things that make the patient actually. This is a typical patient. Approximately two-thirds of the patients come in this kind of CAT scan. This is a picture like you could get if someone can cut your finger in half like this, maxillary and CAT scan. And this is lymph nodes encasing, this is one pipe just after it's split, they can afford to divide that outside. This is fluid floating around the ribcage, that's tumor pressing through the cave, this is the aorta. And this is often how patients come in. This is a malignant effusion. This is an opportunity for research because a lot of patients are going to die with pleural effusion. There's something interesting about the microbiome of the pleural space. Pleural space tends to have inhibition of natural pleural cells. We often squirt talcum powder in there to make the lungs stick to the ribs so the fluid comes back when patients go home. And you have this catheter in. And so this would be an opportunity for a research project where patients can draw fluids essentially and see if there's any change in the character of the blood fluid. That's another opportunity to reduce. I don't think we harness the bath of your system much too quick. This is from the paper I sent around to you, or they sent to you by email, just showing now how we treat lung cancer. Just 10 years ago, very, very crude. You see the small cell and non-small cell. Small cells are one side of chemotherapy, non-small cells are that whole other cancer chemotherapy. They didn't look at mutations, they didn't do anything like this. And as a consequence, that's why the results are not good. To go look at the same thing, it'd be a different thing broken. Occasionally it would be a home run. But now this is the
This is more of the, this is from your paper we sent you, just read it, but basically, first line treatment means that cisplatin, like I mentioned, and then if they have these other ALK, EGFR, which I mentioned it to you earlier, these would be reasons to give these other drugs. PD-L1 is really becoming quite, for patients that have more, basically cells that look more bizarre to the immune system, melanomas, these drugs become very popular. And now for lung cancer, especially squamous cell, in the Vole lab, pembrolizumab, that basically stimulates the immune system very often used first line now, sort of stage four situations. This is another pathway just to kind of to show you how this is from the NCCN criteria. I put that in there. I'll just skip through this. It's just more stuff. I'm going to take these slides out, I think, for next year, to just go through the ways of thinking about approaching the chemotherapy and the pathways for these tumors. Now, this is a big deal here at Roswell. We developed this internally, this OmniSeq. When I was at Rutgers, they would send all the they'd have to send it out. They send it to Foundation Medicine. And a patient that comes in with stage 4 lung cancer, knowing that a lot of the gene mutations that they have, we don't know. We don't know it. So the things like the ALK and the things we can target, the EGFR, may still only be about 10-20% of patients. So they're sending patients for all these other variations and seeing if there might be a drug out there that's been maybe approved for treating breast cancer or some other diseases. The patient may have one of those mutations that maybe a different drug could be used. And this is now called OmniSeq, and it's a CLIA approved lab. And the it's become so complicated that we report it out with for the commission. You get a basically a long report like this, and you know, citing the My Genome database and the various drugs that are out there that might be capable of targeting some of these pathways. So just kind of gave this gives you an example of some of the things that we had on the slides today. Gives you the gene, there's an amplification, a mutation, and then it gives you actually a reference to the clinician that, you know, if you've got nothing else to offer this patient, maybe you can try this to get the therapy. Because what used to happen in the past, that if the patient was not getting better, they would go to the second line, which often didn't work, or the third line, and it would be totally not good at all to anything that might be actually wrong with the patient's tumor. And then this is the, I think, my last slide here. This is really the way that the PD-L1's therapy, like the pembrolizumab, works. So if you have a situation where your tumor cell has these receptors, PD-L1, and also these PD-L1 surface proteins, inhibit the PD-1, which turns on the T cells, and also the B7-1. Anything that stimulates that can shut down the host immune system. And the drugs basically block their competitive attachment to that receptor, and then allow basically the immune system to actually see the tumor cell. Most of the time, you have all these immune cells sitting in the tumor itself, not doing anything. And it really, so you can see patients just really go on the deathbed practically and start on the therapy. And some can come back and survive a long period of time. The downside of this type of therapy is it does turn on the immune system sort of thing. So there's problems with people who never had a heart transplant or amazing to me, I used to do heart transplants and people who go smoke. So if you turn the immune system, how do you adjust the immune suppression in a different way? Because they can reject the organs. Or they can develop a disease like rheumatoid arthritis or some other autoimmune disease. So, but very
got a lot of content in that presentation. We can answer a few minutes of questions. I think the main purpose of this is to try to give you an overview of kind of what lung cancer patients are like, how we have to, how we have to deal with them when we see patients that come in with low-grade disease. Sometimes the patients are unable to tolerate this therapy. It can be that they can catch a cure because of the tumor or because they're older. And, other things we're doing now is try to quantify the patient's capabilities by things like their blood source. And we try to now get patients stronger if they're weak because they're weaker. And the ability to try to strengthen something that they can have surgery or have some of these So any other questions? Let's how much what did you hear do you have some of it? Right? 2 weeks of that stuff. I always think this lecture when people are thinking about patients to see it's out there. Think about that going to summer vacations. I hope you guys have a good summer vacation. And if you've got any questions, just let me know.